readers, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, with a show that salutes two important events. February's month-long commemoration of African American history, and this weekend's President's Day. This edition of The Book Report will spotlight some wonderful titles for both. And we'll speak again with the editor of Audiophile magazine to get an insider's look at key titles of the month. Now, let's turn to page one of The Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz, we're there when you can't be.
The names Elizabeth Eckford and Hazel Bryan Massary may not be well known, but the image of them from September 1957 surely is. An African-American high school girl dressed in white, walking stoically in front of the Little Rock Central High School, and a white girl standing directly behind her, her face twisted in hate. This famous photograph captures the full anguish of desegregation in Little Rock and throughout the South. It was an epic moment in America's civil rights movement. In Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock, author David Margolick tells the remarkable story of two separate lives unexpectedly intersecting. He explores how the haunting picture of Elizabeth and Hazel came to be taken, its significance in the wider world, and why, for the next half century, neither woman escaped its long shadow. Carrington McDuffie narrates.
They did not know, nor, in the world of the South in the 1950s, would they have ever encountered each other before, except perhaps when they rode the same buses or passed on a downtown street, or sat on different levels in a local movie theater. But within an hour or so they would, and from that moment on, their lives would be inextricably intertwined. For long after that, as long in fact as the tortured saga of relations between the races in the United States and everywhere else still mattered, or as long, when it came right down to it, as people can see, they would be linked. When Hazel got home that afternoon, she took off the dress and changed into something more comfortable, boys' jeans, perhaps, they didn't yet make them for girls, and hung it up for the next time. Doubtless, there would be many next times, dances, dates, more school days, to put it on. But when Elizabeth removed her skirt that night, then folded it up and handed it to her mother, she already knew she would never wear it or even want to see it again. As everyone else was coming to recognize it, for a time that simple cotton skirt was just about the most famous piece of clothing in the world, Elizabeth set out to forget about it. It promptly went into the attic, and no one, Elizabeth included, ever laid eyes on it again. Chapter 1. Elizabeth Eckford's house sat on a short stretch of West 18th Street, just off Peyton. Everything about the building and the land it rested on was compact, as if someone had sat down and figured out the smallest and most inexpensive way to fulfill a dream, a place of one's own. The home was squat and square, with two bedrooms on a single floor, along with a crawl space below and a small attic, accessible only via a ladder. The place was rudimentary, unfinished. The pine floors, for instance, had never been varnished. The front yard was tidy and tiny. There was room for a small garden or a lawn, but not really enough for both, and certainly not enough for a tree. No one had ever bothered with the backyard, where a big rock stuck out of the dirt. A local black doctor, who'd grown rich performing abortions and speculating in real estate, had built it in the late 1940s, and the Eckfords, Elizabeth's parents, Oscar Jr., and Bertie, her older sister Anna, and her younger brothers, Oscar III and Bolden, were the first folks ever to live there, moving in on Elizabeth's 8th birthday in October 1949. That was a time, shortly after World War II, when if you scrambled enough, even the relatively poor could own their own homes. The house had grown with the family, as two more children, Melbert Don and Catherine, had come along. The Eckfords had added a couple of rooms to the back.
That was Elizabeth and Hazel by David Margolick. This is a sweeping biography of the man generally considered to be the greatest president of the 20th century. Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of FDR by H.W. Brands examines anew FDR's formative years, his remarkable willingness to champion the poor and disenfranchised, and his combination of political genius, firm leadership, and matchless diplomacy. Drawing on archival materials, public speeches, personal correspondence, and accounts by family and close associates, Brands sheds new light on FDR. How important was the influence of his dominating mother? And with Eleanor, their often tense and always unusual partnership, and her indispensable contribution to his presidency. Most of all, the book traces FDR's revolutionary efforts with the New Deal legislation to transform the American political economy in order to save it, his forceful leadership before and during World War II, and his lasting legacy in creating the foundations of the post-war international order. Mark Deacon narrates.
The president had long prided himself on clever appointments, but no appointment had tickled him more than his tapping of Knox, a Republican from the stronghold of American isolationism, Chicago. By reaching out to the Republicans not once but twice, at the same time that he chose Knox, Roosevelt named Republican Henry Stimson Secretary of War, the president signaled a desire for a bipartisan foreign policy. By picking a Chicagoan, Roosevelt poked a finger in the eye of the arch-isolationist Chicago Tribune, a poke that hurt the more as Knox was the publisher of the rival Chicago Daily News. Roosevelt might have chuckled to himself again, reflecting on how he had cut the ground from under the isolationists, one square foot at a time. But the recent developments were no laughing matter. 4 years had passed since his quarantine speech in Chicago, which had warned against German and Japanese aggression. The strength of the isolationists had prevented him from following up at that time, or for many months thereafter. But by reiterating his message again and again, and with the help of Hitler and the Japanese, who repeatedly proved him right, he gradually brought the American people around to his way of thinking. He persuaded Congress to amend America's neutrality laws and to let the democracies purchase American weapons for use against the fascists. He sent American destroyers to Britain to keep the sea lanes open. His greatest coup was Lend-Lease, the program that made America the armory of the anti-fascist alliance. He had done everything but ask Congress to declare war. The Sunday papers thought this final step might come soon. He knew more than the papers did, and he thought so too. But there was something he didn't know or even imagine. Roosevelt was still reading the papers when an American minesweeper on a pre-dawn patrol 2 miles off the southern coast of the Hawaiian island of Oahu, near the entrance to Pearl Harbor, spotted what looked like a periscope. No American submarines were supposed to be in the area, and the minesweeper reported the sighting to its backup, the destroyer Ward. The report provoked little alarm, partly because Hawaii was so far from Japan, and partly because Pearl Harbor's shallow bottom seemed sufficient protection against enemy subs. Some officers on the ward questioned the sighting. Eyes play tricks in the dark. Perhaps there was an American sub in the area. This wouldn't have been the first time overzealous security or a simple screw-up had prevented information from reaching the patrols. In any event, the ward responded slowly to the asserted sighting and spent most of the next 2 hours cruising the area and discovering nothing.
That was Traitor to His Class by H.W. Brands. Readers, I'm thrilled to welcome Robin Witten back to the Book Report. Robin is the editor of Audiophile magazine, an amazing resource for book lovers. For the past 20 years, Audiophile has chronicled the industry and brought us an insider's look at the titles, the authors, and the narrators. Welcome, Robin. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here, Elaine.
Well, before we get into the theme of this week's show, I just have a general question I've been wondering about. How do narrators actually get selected to perform a book? Sometimes the matchups are fabulous, and sometimes they seem really ill-suited.
Well, you know, Elaine, that's one of the key features about an audiobook that can make or break it. As we know, it's the voice making the magic here. And I think that publishers do it a little differently, but these are casting decisions, just like movies are or plays are cast. And the producer will do selections from people they've used before. Sometimes they do actual auditions. But they're trying to match the book with the narrator. I mean, everyone tries to do that. There are lots of factors that come into play. But, you know, that's how it's done. With an audition, different producers have slightly different approaches. And it makes for an interesting mix.
Does the author have a say?
Sometimes it depends actually on the author. I think often the author is offered a say in the process. Sometimes they demand a say in the process. And sometimes they're not interested at all. Hmm. So it really depends. But authors do often review a selection of voices. And, you know, give their opinions and sometimes make the decisions. But, you know, I often think that knowing what the casting directors and the producers know is that sometimes, you know, their selections, you know, should be followed.
Right.
Because in a short clip, you may not actually get the full sense of what an actor can do.
Have you ever heard of a situation where the author really wanted to narrate the book themselves and the producers had the final say and said, maybe not so much?
Well, I don't know who comes out on the winning side of a situation like that. I think it happens, and sometimes the authors win out and they do read their own work. Sometimes not to the, you know, it doesn't come out exactly the way they had hoped or the way the producers hoped. But I think, you know, I think that the audio publishers do listen to the authors and what the authors want.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's jump into our show this week, which is saluting both African American history, and this is our President's Day show as well. Okay, so one book that we're previewing today is about Claudette Colvin, and I know that you also previewed this book and talk about that and also the narrator.
Well, the Claudette Colvin, the Twice Towards Justice. Is a book that got a lot of attention nationally because it was the winner of the 2009 National Book Award for Young People's Literature. And I think that at that time, that category was quite new, if not maybe almost the first time it had been given out. And so the book was important, and we had heard about the recording coming for the Claudette Colvin a little after the award was given. And when it arrived, it was a stunning success because in print, the history of this incident in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, was not a piece of history that was known well. We know about Rosa Parks and the role that she played in the civil rights at that time, and for many years after. But Claudette was a teenager in 1955, and she also refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery City bus. And what's interesting is that this book by Phil Hose was written for young people. It was, and the narrator, Chaney Waits, who reads it, has such a power to speak to directly to teens and to listeners of all ages, really. But she embodies Claudette as a young teenager with all the fire of her rebellion and her feelings of injustice, and then also as Claudette looks back in her life, she is able to capture that.
Okay, the next book I'd like to talk about is Elizabeth and Hazel, which was so impactful. Give us some background on that.
Well, Elizabeth and Hazel is set almost at the same time, 1957. I mean, it starts in 1957, and is a look at the two women who were pictured in one of those photojournalism images that has stayed in our minds and in our history of the segregation and integration of schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as you recall, it was the black teenager going to school with her books, and that was Elizabeth, and with a absolutely near hysterical crowd around her, with one particular young woman, a white woman, hurling epithets and racial slurs at this young black student in front of her. And this is the story of Hazel, who was pictured screaming at Elizabeth, and Elizabeth calmly going to school. And, you know, it's their whole lives were impacted by that photograph, and of course the whole incident of being part of what was going on in integration in Little Rock. So the historian David Margolick has taken on the sort of dual biography and history, and it's really interestingly done and read by Carrington McDuffie. And Carrington is an actress who has to portray both a black woman and a white woman in this biography. Also have a certain detachment, because that's the author's point of view as a historian, and she does it really well. She has a wonderfully warm voice with a southern accent, but not a lot of accent, and so she's able to engage us in the lives of these girls and the women and everything that unfolded around that incident.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much a part of our national iconography, and the book is really wonderful. All right, what about another book we previewed is Heart and Soul, with Debbie Allen as the narrator?
Yes. Now this is quite different because Heart and Soul is by Kadir Nelson. You can listen to the audio book, but it also comes from an amazing illustrated children's book, and Kadir Nelson is known for his books, but also for particularly for his illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what's interesting about what Debbie Allen is able to do is that she is a storyteller, and that she, the narrator in the book, is an elderly black woman looking back, telling history to you as the listener, a young listener in particular. She speaks to as if she has a few grandchildren around her skirts. and it's so engaging in her warmth.
You know, and speaking about history, of course, we previewed several presidential histories, as it is President's Day. And one thing that's really remarkable, and love you to speak about it, is how skillful some of the narrators are to bring real life and impact to books that could be fairly dry. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because it's such a feat. I mean, if you look at the Traitor to His Class title that you've previewed about Roosevelt, that's 37 hours long as an audiobook.
That's a commitment.
It's on both parts, certainly for the listener, but for Mark Deakins, who's done a lot of nonfiction, you know, he has to maintain the energy, his energy, the energy of the book, the movement through the book, and not put anybody to sleep. So that is really, it's important not to overdo it, because this is history and it's written with an objective and very detailed view that doesn't have a lot of colorful characters, although of course they are. That, you know, he maintains an objectivity and a certain clarity to his narration.
Mm. Well, Robin, share again, please. I know we talked about it last month, but your website and how readers can learn more about Audiophile Magazine.
Yes, Audiophile Magazine is in print, as well as our active website at audiophilemagazine.com. And our February-March issue features hearing black history with a special look at some of the music makers and black musicians and artists who have brought a lot of music, theater, dance to all of our ears, if you will.
Okay. Well, thanks, Robin, and we look forward to speaking with you again next month.
Thank you so much, Elaine.
All right. Talk to you then. Bye.
Bye.
On March 2nd, 1955, a slim, bespectacled teenager refused to give up her seat to a white woman on a segregated bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Shouting, "It's my constitutional right," as police dragged her off to jail, Claudette Colvin decided she'd had enough of the Jim Crow segregation laws that had angered and puzzled her since she was a young child. But instead of being celebrated, as Rosa Parks would be when she took the same stand 9 months later, Claudette found herself shunned by many of her classmates and dismissed as an unfit role model by the black leaders of Montgomery. Undaunted, she put her life in danger a year later when she dared to challenge segregation yet again as one of the four plaintiffs in the landmark busing case, Browder versus Gale. Claudette Colvin, twice toward justice, is based on extensive interviews with Claudette Colvin and many others. Author Philip Hoos presents the first in-depth account of a major yet little-known civil rights figure whose story provides a fresh perspective on the Montgomery bus protest of 1955 to 56. Historical figures like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks play important roles, but center stage belongs to the brave, bookish girl whose two acts of courage were to affect the course of American history. The title is narrated by Shaney Waits.
Jim Crow kept blacks and whites from learning together, playing or eating meals together, working or riding buses or trains together, worshiping with one another, even going up and down in the same elevator or throwing a ball back and forth in the same park. Black and white citizens drank water from separate fountains and used different bathrooms. They were forbidden to play sports on the same team, marry one another, or swim together in the same pool. Some of the segregation laws didn't matter too much in the daily lives of Black citizens, but the bus was different. Riding the bus was like having a sore tooth that never quit aching. Montgomery's neighborhoods were spread out, and the maids and yard boys, people like Claudette Colvin's parents who scraped together a few dollars a day by attending to the needs of white families, depended on the buses to reach the homes of their white employers. Thousands of students also rode the buses to school from the time they were little, learning the transfer points and schedules by heart. They gathered in clusters at the corners, chatting and teasing and cramming for tests until the green and gold buses chugged into view and the door snapped open. Most Blacks had to ride the bus. Sidebar: Montgomery Transportation Pioneer. In 1886, Montgomery became the first city in the Western Hemisphere to convert a street railway system to electricity. The trolley line was proudly known as the Lightning Route. 20 years later, on November 23, 1906, Montgomery also became the first U.S. city to totally segregate public transportation. A city ordinance passed on that day said Blacks in all public accommodations had to be completely separated from whites. Despite the grumblings of the trolley company owners, who did not want to pay for new cars, totally separate trolley cars for Blacks were established. Everything about riding a bus was humiliating for Black passengers. All riders entered through the front door and dropped their dimes in the fare box near the driver. But unless the entire white section was empty, Blacks alone had to get back off the bus and re-enter through the rear door. Sometimes the driver pulled away while Black passengers were still standing outside. In other southern cities, like Atlanta and Nashville and Mobile, Black passengers sat in the back and whites sat in the front of the bus, with the two groups coming together in the middle as the bus filled up. When all the seats were taken, riders of both races stood. But Montgomery had its own rules and traditions. Here, each bus had 36 seats. The first four rows of seats, which held 10 passengers, were reserved for white passengers only. Day after day, weary Black passengers remained standing over empty seats in front. Trying to hold onto their packages and small children, they jostled for balance even as the aisles became jammed with dozens of seatless passengers. Seating behind the first 10 seats was up to the driver, who constantly glanced into the mirror above his head to keep track of who was sitting where. If the 10 white seats in front were filled, the driver ordered Black passengers to surrender their seats in the middle and rear of the bus to newly boarding white passengers. In fact, if even one white passenger wanted to sit in a row occupied by four Black riders, the driver would glance up and yell, "I need those seats." All four Blacks were expected to stand up and make their way to the rear. It didn't matter if they were elderly, pregnant, ill, or balancing children on their laps. It also didn't matter that the city bus law, or ordinance as city laws are called, had said since 1900 that no rider had to give up a seat unless another was available.
That was Claudette Colvin by Philip Hoos. Charles Flood spotlights the end of one president's life in Grant's final victory, Ulysses S. Grant's heroic last year. Shortly after losing all of his wealth in 1884, Ulysses S. Grant learned he had terminal throat and mouth cancer. Destitute and dying, Grant began to write his memoirs to save his family from permanent financial ruin. As Grant continued his work, suffering increasing pain, the American public became aware of this race between Grant's writing and his fatal illness. 20 years after his respectful and magnanimous demeanor toward Robert E. Lee at Appomattox, people in the North and South came to know Grant as the brave, honest man he was, now using his famous determination in this final effort. Grant finished his memoirs just 4 days before he died in July 1885. Published after his death by his friend Mark Twain, Grant's memoirs became an instant bestseller, restoring his family's financial health and, more importantly, helping to cure the nation of bitter discord. Michael Pritchard narrates.
Grant's progression from the presidency to this office in Wall Street was far from predictable. In March of 1877, at the end of his two terms in the White House, Grant and his wife, Julia, set off on a trip around the world that would last for 2 years. Grant was a fundamentally shy man, despite his years in the American public eye. The Grants thought of themselves as sightseers, private citizens taking an extended vacation after his many years of military and civilian public service. Yet, in nation after nation, they found themselves the focus of enormous interest. Wherever they went, crowds gathered to see them. It became clear that Grant, although an unofficial ambassador, was one of the most popular representatives of the United States ever to travel abroad. Although the crowds who flocked to see him knew nothing about his background, they seemed to sense that this son of the successful operator of a small tannery was a man of the people. At the same time, throughout Europe, the Grants were honored and entertained by royalty and other prominent personages. In England, they spent a weekend with Queen Victoria at Windsor Palace. In Rome, they met with the newly installed Pope, Leo XIII. During their visit to Berlin, Prince Otto von Bismarck, Germany's Iron Chancellor, of whom Grant said, "He is, no doubt, the greatest statesman of the present time," spent 2 hours in his office at the Radziwill Palace discussing world affairs with Grant, treating him with great respect as a military and national leader who possessed first-hand knowledge he was eager to acquire. Bismarck knew a highly organized and compartmentalized mind when he encountered one. Describing the way Grant handled the topics that arose at their meeting, he said, "I saw at once that he knew his subject thoroughly, or else he avoided it completely." Eventually, the Grants continued on from Europe to Egypt, India, and the Far East. After visits to China and Japan, during which Grant so impressed the leadership of both nations that they entrusted him with what proved to be the successful settlement of a boundary dispute involving the Ryukyu Islands, the Grants crossed the Pacific on the liner City of Tokyo to return to the United States. As they came ashore in San Francisco in September of 1879, they received an immensely enthusiastic welcome. But as was so often the case with the Grant family, a unique personal story hid behind the headlines. As reported by their 21-year-old son Jesse, who had come west to be reunited with them, "Father and mother were at the Palace Hotel when I rejoined them, and mother was the first to hasten to greet me. 'If your father asks if there is anything peculiar about his articulation, pretend not to notice it,' she urged, after the first breathless greeting. And then mother went on to explain that father's Japanese servant, shipboard steward, had accidentally thrown overboard his dental plate with two teeth attached, and since this loss, he frequently whistled in his speech. True enough, father almost at once asked me if I noticed anything peculiar about his speech, and I promptly answered no, to his evident relief. Grant and Julia then began some months of traveling and living in various places in the United States. This period of Grant's life ended in June of 1880, when his backers at the Republican National Convention in Chicago failed in their clumsy, complacent attempt to make him their party's presidential candidate for a third time. At this point in his life, Grant was ambivalent concerning a third term, but Julia would have enjoyed returning to the White House. That resulted in the nomination and subsequent election of Republican James A. Garfield, a man Grant characterized as not possessed of the backbone of an angleworm. However Garfield might have turned out as a president, he was assassinated 90 days after his inauguration and was succeeded by his vice president, Chester A. Arthur.
That was Grant's final victory by Charles Flood. This
story of America and African Americans is a story of hope and inspiration and unwavering courage, but is also the story of injustice, of a country divided by law, education, and wealth, of a people whose struggles and achievements helped define their country. Keter Nelson, one of this generation's most accomplished artists, has written Heart and Soul, an epic yet intimate introduction to the history of America and African Americans from colonial days through the Civil Rights Movement. Written in the voice of an everywoman, an unnamed narrator whose forebears came to this country on slave ships and who lived to cast her vote for the first African-American president, Heart and Soul touches on some of the great transformative events and small victories of that history. Debbie Allen narrates.
Ever visit the Capitol in Washington, D.C.? It's a beautiful white building made of sandstone and has a big iron dome that rises over the city like a full moon. It was built by slaves and freemen to be a symbol of the liberty Americans had won from England in the American Revolution. Inside the rotunda, there are large paintings and sculptures of famous Americans, big old statues of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. The paintings tell the story of how America came to be. Strange, though, nary a black face in all those pretty pictures. There's plenty of white folks and a few Indians here and there, but none of us. It's as if we never existed, stricken from the record, like Moses from the walls of Egypt. Of course, those fancy paintings ain't telling the whole truth. Black folks have been here at least as long as Europeans. By the early 1600s, English, Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, and French settlers had made their way to America and established colonies all along the East Coast. The colonies were a means for European countries to expand their empires and were also a new source of wealth. Each colony produced crops and mined for riches that were sent back to Europe. Africans had come to America as laborers with the Spanish in Florida in 1565. And about 60 years later with the English in Virginia to do the work of building the colonies and producing what was sent back to Europe. The labor of these Africans helped to create the foundation of America in its early days. So you see, we deserve to be in those pictures just as much as the Europeans and the Indians. And if you really want to know the truth, honey, we are much the reason they would later have a chance to fight for their liberty in the first place. By the mid-1700s, the English colonists had been in America for a few generations. They had gained control of most of the settled land along the eastern seaboard, set up local governments, and made the colonies quite profitable by way of slave-produced crops. Having been in America for so long, many of the colonists had come to think of themselves as American rather than British, and had grown good and tired of living under the thumb of a faraway king. The colonists felt it was time they had a say about how they ran their local governments. They began to talk on the streets, over dinner tables and in taverns about the king's unfair taxes, about his nose's soldiers everywhere, and about splitting from England. They talked about not wanting to be slaves to the king. Slaves? Child, what in the world could they ever know about that? The king had taxed the colonists for everything from paint to glass and paper. He even taxed their tea. People in the colonies had finally had enough. To show the king what they thought of his taxes, they snuck out to his boats and dumped all his tea into the harbor. It wasn't long before the king sent more troops over here to try to put the folks in the colonies back in their place. But it only made relations worse, and the colonists more determined than ever to split with England. In 2 years, there was blood on the streets of Boston. And in one more, Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence to cut ties with England. The American Revolution had begun. There were slaves who fought in that war, but unfortunately, many of them chose the wrong side. By the time of the Revolutionary War, there were more than 450,000 black folks, both slave and free in the colonies. The British had promised freedom to any slave who fought for them. And, honey, That was a powerful thing to tell a slave. So thousands of them joined the British. General George Washington, who was in charge of the American troops, didn't allow black folks in his army. He and the Congress didn't think it was a good idea to put guns in the hands of folks who might well use them against their former masters or other white folks. But Washington changed his mind after he had lost so many of his soldiers to fighting in the pox. Only then were free black folks and some of the slaves allowed to join his army. General Washington was quickly rewarded by all the black men who signed up to help him gain the upper hand.
That was Heart and Soul by Keter Nelson. The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba by award-winning journalist Jim Rasenberger is a gripping account of the Bay of Pigs crisis. It draws on long-hidden CIA documents and delivers the truth and consequences of five pivotal days in April 1961. The U.S.-backed military invasion of Cuba remains one of the most ill-fated blunders in American history. Despite the Kennedy administration's initial public insistence that the U.S. had nothing to do with the invasion, it soon became clear the complex operation had been planned and approved by Washington's best and brightest, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff and JFK. The Cuban-born invaders were trained by the CIA, supplied with American materiel, and shadowed by the U.S. Navy. Landing by sea with fighter plane support, they hoped to spark a counter-revolution against Fidel. The gambit was an abysmal failure, resulting in the death or imprisonment of more than 1,000 men. The Brilliant Disaster is the most complete account of this event to date, providing not only a fast-paced chronicle of the disaster, but an analysis of how it occurred. Bob Walter narrates.
Given that Ms. Perino was born a decade after these events, her uncertainty was understandable. But coming from the woman representing the president who launched the invasion of Iraq in 2003, an exercise that repeated some of the very same mistakes made in Cuba in 1961, it also was unsettling. Presumably, somebody in the Bush White House considered the history of the Bay of Pigs before sending Colin Powell to the Security Council of the United Nations, an episode, as we shall see, bearing striking similarities to Adlai Stevenson's appearance before that same body in April 1961, or ordering a minimal force to conquer a supposedly welcoming foreign land. Then again, if history teaches us any lesson, it is that we do not learn the lessons of history very well. Almost as soon as the mistakes of the Bay of Pigs were catalogued and analyzed by various investigative bodies, America began committing them again, not only in Cuba, but elsewhere in Latin America, in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa. By one count, the United States has forcibly intervened, covertly or overtly, in no fewer than 24 foreign countries since 1961, not including our more recent 21st century entanglements in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of these have, arguably, produced long-term benefits for the United States. Most clearly have not. The surfeit of interventions gives rise to a fair question. Considering all that has occurred since 1961, why should the Bay of Pigs still demand our attention? Next to Vietnam and Iraq, among others, the Bay of Pigs may seem a bump in the road, fading mercifully in the rearview mirror. The entire event lasted a mere 5 days and cost the United States roughly $46 million, less than the average budget of a Hollywood movie these days. 114 men were killed on the American side, and only a handful of these casualties were U.S. citizens. Add to this the fact that America was embarrassed by the Bay of Pigs, and the tale has everything to recommend it for oblivion. Even if we would forget the Bay of Pigs, though, it will not forget us. There, among the mangrove swamps and the coral-jeweled waters, some part of the American story ended, and a new one began. Like a well-crafted prologue, The Bay of Pigs sounded the themes, foreshadowed the conflicts, and laid the groundwork for the decades to follow. And what followed was, in no small measure, a consequence of the events in Cuba in 1961. It would be facile to credit the 1960s to a single failed invasion. Many currents combined to produce that tsunami. But the Bay of Pigs dragged America into the new decade and stalked it for years to come. Three of the major American cataclysms of the 60s and early 70s, John Kennedy's assassination, the Vietnam War, and Watergate, were related by concatenation to the Bay of Pigs. No fewer than four presidents were touched by it, from Dwight Eisenhower, who first approved the program of covert action against Castro, to Richard Nixon, and the six infamous justice-obstructing words he uttered in 1972. The whole Bay of Pigs thing. My telling of the Bay of Pigs thing will certainly not be the first. On the contrary, thousands of pages of official reports, journalism, memoir, and scholarship have been devoted to the invasion, including at least two exceptional books, Haynes Johnson's emotionally charged account published in 1964, and Peter Wyden's deeply reported account from 1979. This audiobook owes a debt to both of those, and to many others, as well as to thousands of pages of once-classified documents that have become available over the past 15 years, thanks in part to the efforts of the National Security Archives, an organization affiliated with George Washington University that seeks to declassify and publish government files.
That was The Brilliant Disaster by Jim Ratzenberger.
Have a new iPad, Nook, or e-reader? New television, laptop, iPod, or appliance? If you've been worrying if your new gadgets will still work next year, then you need Warranty of America. For just $9.95 each month, you get a four-year extended warranty on everything you bought last holiday season, plus everything else you buy for the rest of your life. That's right, just $9.95 per month covers your entire household. It covers an unlimited number of electronics, appliances, and computers. If it plugs in, we protect it. All for just $9.95 per month. Coverage has no deductibles, no additional fees. If they can't fix it or replace it, you'll get your purchase price back. No contract. You can cancel anytime. Order now. Call 877-746-4692 or enter radio with the promotional code at warrantyofamerica.com. You'll get 1 month free, so call 877-746-4692 for Warranty of America. It'll be the last warranty you'll ever need.
Sharifa Rhodes Pitts untangles the myth and meaning of Harlem's storied legacy in Harlem is Nowhere, a journey to the Mecca of Black America. Drawing on the borough's history and her own observations, Rhodes Pitts introduces a variety of observers who shared a common hope that Harlem would become the ground from which blacks fully entered America's democracy. Karen Chilton narrates.
It was odd that he should think of me, even as I crossed my own threshold, as a stranger. Someone on the verge of departure, highly susceptible to the mere mention of flight. I might at that moment have turned around and gone. I might just then have been thinking of it. But it says much about the impermanent status of my residence here. My neighbors were accustomed to seeing me leave with luggage in the earliest part of the morning. I had maintained an innocence of city politics and refused certain hallmarks of the committed citizen of New York, like a red or black wire rolling cart for groceries or a tabloid newspaper selected on the basis of the best horoscopes. I should not have been surprised that some of my neighbors on Lenox Avenue were still trying to understand my presence in their midst. On a different occasion, a different man from outside my door had asked where I was from. He was surprised, pleased even, to hear I was from Texas. "Oh," he'd said, "I thought you were a foreigner." One restless, idle hour, I sat at the library on 135th Street and consulted the Columbia Lippincott Gazetteer of the World, copying out the following entry as if to gain my bearings. Harlem. a residential and business district of North Manhattan Borough of New York City, Southeast New York, bounded approximately by Central Park and 110th Street South, East River East, Harlem River Northeast, 168th Street West. Largest Negro community, population more than 400,000 in U.S., grew up here after 1910. One of the most congested districts in U.S., Harlem also has large colonies of Puerto Rican, Italian, and Latin American background. The Dutch settlement of New Harlem was established here 1658 by Peter Stuyvesant. In the Revolution, Continental forces stopped the British advance up Manhattan in battle, September 1776, of Harlem Heights. Area remained virtually rural until improvement in 19th century of transportation links with Lower Manhattan. Public housing projects begun in 1930s and other attempts to relieve unfavorable conditions there have been made. At first, it seems to give an all-encompassing view, complete with official borders, colonial heroics, and important urban planning highlights, yet it manages to say nothing at all. In search of further detail, I seized upon another definition from the pages of the Handbook of Geographical Nicknames. This volume reveals that a city called Hankou is the Pittsburgh of China, that the Happy Valley refers to war-torn Kashmir, and to the Riverine Gorge cut by the Tennessee, and that the Harz Mountains of Germany, the location of the silver mines where Leibniz once toiled, is now or once was the stronghold of paganism. Situated near these is Harlem, whose nickname, the capital of the Negro population of the United States, was not nearly as catchy or evocative as I'd expected. Though the phrase lacks poetry, it retains an accidental precision. The outdated term, Negro, already antique when the book was published in 1980, fixes our attention on the past. At the library, I found another source of coordinates. Harlem is blocked in by the high ridges of Morningside Heights and St. Nicholas Terrace, by the East and Harlem Rivers, and by Central Park. Those declared boundaries did not tell me anything new. More important was the action of those physical frontiers. Harlem is blocked in. Geography is destiny. The WPA Guide to New York City, first published in 1939, goes on to describe who and what is blocked in by those ridges, those rivers, and that pastoral fiction of a park. Negro Harlem, into which are crowded more than a quarter of a million Negroes from southern states, the West Indies, and Africa, has many different aspects. To whites seeking amusement, it is an exuberant, original, and unconventional entertainment center. To Negro college graduates, it is an opportunity to practice a profession among their own people.
That was Harlem is Nowhere by Sharifa Rhodes Pitts. And to close our show today, I wanted you to hear a wonderful title, Speeches and Writings of Abraham Lincoln, narrated with warmth and wisdom by my friend Alan Sklar. Abraham Lincoln was undeniably one of the most influential politicians in American history. In this collection of letters, speeches, and other writings by Lincoln, listeners can gain a uniquely intimate perspective on our 16th president. From personal letters to friends and family, to his speeches as an Illinois state legislature and U.S. representative, from his first inaugural address to the Emancipation Proclamation and the famous Gettysburg Address, Lincoln addresses such important political issues as slavery and states' rights and relates his personal views on marriage and depression. This is a glorious glimpse into the mind of one of America's greatest statesmen, a must-listen for anyone interested in Lincoln's life and legacy.
This thing of living in Springfield is rather a dull business, after all. At least it is so to me. I'm quite as lonesome here as I ever was anywhere in my life. I have been spoken to by but one woman since I have been here, and should not have been by her if she could have avoided it. I've never been to church yet, and probably shall not be soon. I stay away because I am conscious I should not know how to behave myself. I am often thinking of what we said about your coming to live at Springfield. I am afraid you would not be satisfied. There is a great deal of flourishing about in carriages here, which it would be your doom to see without sharing it. You would have to be poor without the means of hiding your poverty. Do you believe you could bear that patiently? Whatever woman may cast her lot with mine, should any ever do so, it is my intention to do all in my power to make her happy and contented. And there is nothing I can imagine that would make me more unhappy than to fail in the effort. I know I should be much happier with you than the way I am, provided I saw no signs of discontent in you. What you have said to me may have been in the way of jest, or I may have misunderstood you. If so, then let it be forgotten. If otherwise, I much wish you would think seriously before you decide. What I have said, I will most positively abide by, provided you wish it. My opinion is that you had better not do it. You have not been accustomed to hardship, and it may be more severe than you now imagine. I know you are capable of thinking correctly on any subject, and if you deliberate maturely upon this subject before you decide, then I am willing to abide your decision. You must write me a good long letter after you get this. You have nothing else to do. And though it might not seem interesting to you after you had written it, it would be a good deal of company to me in this busy wilderness. Tell your sister I don't want to hear any more about selling out and moving. That gives me the hypo whenever I think of it. Yours, etc., Lincoln. To Mary Owens, Springfield, August 16th, 1837. Friend Mary, you will no doubt think it rather strange that I should write you a letter on the same day on which we parted, and I can only account for it by supposing that seeing you lately makes me think of you more than usual. While at our late meeting we had but few expressions of thoughts, you must know that I cannot see you or think of you with entire indifference. And yet it may be that you are mistaken in regard to what my real feelings toward you are. If I knew you were not, I should not have troubled you with this letter. Perhaps any other man would know enough without information, but I consider it my peculiar right to plead ignorance and your bounden duty to allow the plea. I want in all cases to do right, and most particularly so in all cases with women. I want, at this particular time, more than anything else, to do right with you. And if I knew it would be doing right, as I rather suspect it would, to let you alone, I would do it. And for the purpose of making the matter as plain as possible, I now say that you can drop the subject, dismiss your thoughts, if you ever had any, from me forever, and leave this letter unanswered without calling forth one accusing murmur from me. And I will even go further and say that, if it will add anything to your comfort or peace of mind to do so, it is my sincere wish that you should.
That was Speeches and Writings of Abraham Lincoln. Readers, thanks so much for joining us today. As you celebrate the President's Day holiday, I hope you have the opportunity to pick up one of these titles and celebrate our great country. Or, for other titles in a star-spangled array of genres, check out my website, bookreportradio.com. Enjoy your time off with friends and family, and of course, a great book. See you back here next week on The Book Report.